I'm here now at the Pacific Science Center, and I'm here with Sarah Moore, who's the Life Sciences Manager. And maybe you could tell me, who's in your lap there, Sarah?
I have Madagascar hissing cockroaches. I have two of them in here in this carrier.
What are you going to do with them?
I'm going to take them out and show them to people, and anybody who feels like it can have a seat and hold one.
Well, you're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's show is all about creatures and the various ways that our lives intersect with theirs. And so to get us underway here, I have brought my supervisor, Aaron Hennessy, news director at KPLU. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, hi.
I think that we're going to introduce you to these cockroaches, mostly because I don't care to meet them all that intimately.
So I'm going to open the carrier, and I'm going to pick up one cockroach. Oh, he hissed. Okay. You ready?
Ready.
Here he goes.
Oh, tickly.
And oh, he's exploring a little bit with his antennae.
Oh, little guy. I can feel the little hooks on his little feet.
So one thing I noticed that you're not doing, Aaron, is doing the little crazy dance and going, which is what a lot of people would do. How come?
Because when I was a child, my sister Molly and I were very competitive. And we had this thing when bees would land on us, we would compete with each other about being as still as possible and not brushing off the bee and seeing who could hold out the longest. And we became very good at just having insects, particularly bees, land on us, being totally still, going into some, you know, zenny state. So to this day, when a bee lands on me or I come across an insect, I'm not scared. I like it.
Aaron, do you think that Molly would have the guts to do what you're doing still?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. No way.
Well, all our complicated feelings toward creatures, that's coming up this week on Sound Effect. But first, as always, we are going to hit the highlights of the week's news with a panel of guests, so stick around for that. Okay, folks, so maybe you didn't catch every single news story that came out this week, or maybe you heard some, but you weren't totally clear on why you were supposed to care about it. Actually, I think I'm talking about all of us pretty much every week here, except possibly for Josh. Well, this is a news amnesty. We are going to be catching you up on all the stories that you might have missed, as well as talking about our nominees for Underreported Story of the Week. And here to help me do that, the Josh I mentioned is Josh Feit. He is news editor at Seattle Met Magazine and founder and editor of their political blog, Publicola. Tanya Mosley is a broadcast journalist based here in Seattle. And Kyle Stokes is youth and education reporter at KPLU. Welcome, everybody, to Sound Effect.
Hiya. Thank you for having us.
So for the top story this week, we're going to dig into this issue of students and staff and teachers and parents boycotting or not boycotting standardized tests. And this has sort of flared up quite a bit this week. And Kyle, you've been covering this. You've been really knee-deep in it. So maybe you could recap it for us.
Okay. So I guess if you want to go back to the very beginning on this, this all started in late February up at Nathan Hale High School here in Seattle, kind of on the north end of town. A building leadership team is what it's called. They voted, this is parents, students, but mostly teachers and administrators in that building saying, we don't want to give just the juniors the standardized tests that they're supposed to take this year per federal law. It's the way that the state complies with the No Child Left Behind law that you've all probably heard of by now. But it started really with the teachers there saying, we're not going to give this test. The district kind of heard them out, eventually came back and said, no, you really got to give this test and we're going to discipline or even fire teachers who refuse to give this test. So it sort of forced the school to turn around. But by then, this movement had kind of taken off. And at Hale now, as well as at Garfield, we just learned, at Roosevelt and Ingram High School, so four high schools in Seattle, now about half of the junior class at that school, so about half of 1,400 students total, have submitted letters saying they're going to refuse to take this test. That's their right under Washington state law. And it really goes to show how much angst there is over standardized testing in general right now. This is a test that none of them need to graduate from high school. And, you know, so they're opting out.
And Josh Feit, what questions does this raise for you as this has been unfolding here in Seattle? What have you been wondering about?
You know, something that often occurs to me And I applaud, you know, I think it's always inspiring when students particularly kind of do protest. However, I think there's a real question that comes to the forefront, which is, what are the standards? What are we teaching? How do we hold teachers accountable? And I think people that get kind of knee-jerk behind this movement need to kind of flip the lens for a second. There are two sort of frontline services in public policy, right? Teachers and cops are kind of the two places where the public is paying tax dollars, and really, this is how society, this is what where society, where the rubber meets the road. And on one hand, progressives in Seattle sort of demand more accountability from police. And the problem is the police union and the conservative police union. They don't want to be held accountable, right? Flip that. Stop picking on the teachers union. Stop picking on the teachers union. They don't have to take these tests. So that raises that issue for me, and I wonder if there's a broader perspective. I'm not saying, again, I mean, I think kind of, if you want to use a dramatic term, civil disobedience of students and teachers kind of questioning a standardized test and the anxiety of high-stakes testings. I totally get it. I think that there's problems with these tests. I think people, though, need to step back from the drama of that and ask the larger question, okay, what's the way to go about holding teachers accountable?
I think this is like a really interesting question that I don't think anybody in the state right now has a good answer to, is how do we hold teachers accountable in a way that acknowledges teachers' fears about the tests that are being used to judge their performance? And I think, you know, when you look at a test like this where so many students are not projected to do well, they would argue, I mean, that's a huge morale issue. And kids are going to come into these tests, and if they're not needing them to graduate, they're frankly not going to care.
Well, Kyle and Josh, you bring up the big elephant in the room. The problem is, if you talk with these teachers, if you talk with the administrators, they actually do have solutions, but the solutions require a complete overhaul of the educational system, and that's the issue here. So what the system is trying to do right now with this test is to be able to overhaul the system and then go into a new system, which is the Common Core. But to do that, that's what's ironic about it, is they need a test to be able to then go into this new system. And really, I think that no one is reporting this because it is very much, it's such a huge issue to say we need to overhaul the system and we're not prepared to do it financially, and we're just not prepared to do it systematically.
Just very briefly, Kyle, is this a rehash of the MAP test protest, or is this a Common Core revolt?
I don't think this is necessarily a revolt against the standards, I think there is some of that baked in there. I don't think this is a rehash of the MAP test debate, although, you know, you can't deny with Jesse Hagopian, who is the prominent leader of that MAP test boycott, at the microphone at the press conference this week.
The Garfield High teacher.
Yeah, the Garfield High School teacher. You can't deny that there are elements of that baked into there. I have found this to be a lot more connected to bigger questions of policy. I find this connected to the story that I would say is my underreported story of the week, which is the big possible tectonic movements of federal education policy. I know that sounds really abstract, but in Congress right now, there has been, and we've been talking about this literally for going on 8 years right now, because this No Child Left Behind law has been in desperate need of reauthorization. No one likes this law. No one wants to see it continue, but nobody can agree how to fix it. Until maybe this week, including Washington's Senator Patty Murray got together with the Republican chair of the Education Committee in the Senate, in the U.S. Senate, and they came up with a compromise to change No Child Left Behind. And one of the pieces of that was there would be a lot more flexibility granted to states in terms of how they judged how teachers and schools were doing, how they rated that using tests. And the statement that the Republican chair put out is that this compromise, he said, quote, should produce fewer and more appropriate tests. So, I mean, and this was an issue that we sort of heard about. It kind of flared up on Monday. This is a huge deal. This
I thought that was
going to
be a huge story this week. I'm not. I got to tell you.
And that is what I think is this is all about. There's MAP test in here. There's a little bit of Common Core revolt in terms of the concerns over the tests. But I think this is about what they're talking about in Washington right now. How do we do testing in high schools? And I think that what we're hearing from parents is this isn't how we do it.
I think ed nerds are just in heaven this week.
Oh yeah.
Well, as long as we've moved into Olympia and our underreported stories, Tanya Mosley, what's your underreported story this week?
Overall, I feel like I'm very disappointed in coverage of the legislature and what's happening there. And very specifically, I was very much interested in what would happen with this bill regarding cell phone use in cars. Prior to it making it to the legislature, we'd heard so much about it. We'd heard that, because we all know it's a big issue, people driving, using their cell phones, not only just to talk, but to surf the internet, to text. And while it is illegal to text and drive, there wasn't specific language that spoke to that in using it in your hand and actually texting while driving. And also surfing the internet, also using it for maps. Right. So I thought that this would definitely be a step forward in us having clearer language.
Yeah, there's been such a drumbeat about this.
Absolutely. Like there was a drumbeat. And it died. It died right away. And I was out of town last week, so I came back and I wanted to see what happened. And all I saw was maybe two or three blurbs that it had died in the legislature and now we're moving on. Well, what happened? That's what I want to know. What happened? What were the things in play that actually made this die when we were talking about it so much? I think there just needed to be more reporting, and overall more reporting what's coming out of the legislature in general. I mean, I just feel very hungry for more information about what's happening there.
On that note, Josh Feit, your underreported story?
Well, my underreported story relates to the legislature, and that is that Governor Inslee came out swinging for a cap and trade to raise $1 billion for the budget to essentially put a chit on carbon and have big polluters pay, and big fanfare about that. And of course, it didn't make it into the Republicans' budget, but it also didn't make it into the Democrats' budget. Here's this major environmental push by the governor, the leader of the Democratic Party, and the House Democrats, where they have a majority, did not even put it in their budget. Now, I talked to them both. I talked to both House Democrats and the governor's office yesterday, and they both say it's still in play. We have talks. Members had questions about it. But what I found interesting about this is, in one of the larger issues in the legislature this session, the transportation budget, the Democrats just trashed the Republicans for being not conscious of environmental problems, and particularly they put in a poison pill that prevents the governor from instituting low carbon fuel standards. So here they are with an opportunity to at least put some environmentalism in the bargaining table, and they just bail.
Huh. Yeah. I think it's interesting to cast this event, like you say, it's still in play, but how it's not been a starter in the political scene in Olympia right now. When you look at Inslee as a candidate for future office, I mean, I think you really have to ask the question, what is he going to run on? You know, if he decides to run for re-election. And I think that this is one of those things that it's his signature issue. He wrote a book about this. And this is something that he tied directly into the McCleary decision, how we're going to fund education, how we're going to fund mental health, and how we're going to deal with transportation issues. And this is sort of where we are with this right now, is questioning whether or not it's going to be in play as the session goes down the home stretch. And if I were Inslee's campaign people right now, I'd have to be sort of tallying up as substantive looking a list as I can get together of what he's done that I can campaign on. What are going to be what's a voter issue that I can put in front of the public and say, this is why I deserve four more years.
Well, on that note, we will leave it this week. Thank you so much to Josh Feit of Seattle Met and Publicola, Kyle Stokes of KPLU, and Tanya Mosley, Seattle-based broadcast journalist. I really appreciate you guys being on Sound Effect.
Thank you for having us.
Lots of fun.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're talking about creatures and our relationships with creatures. And Katie Sewell's here with me now, independent producer, to talk about one creature in particular. And that is which one?
The crow.
So the crow. Katie, I got to tell you, I mean, I've always thought of crows as being particularly rude animals. You know, I mean, I can't think of a picnic I've gone on in Seattle where they haven't carried off some part of my lunch. I mean, why should I have anything but contempt for these animals?
Well, I feel that's a limited view, Gabe. Let's say you were eating that sandwich and instead of turning your back and they mischievously take it away, what if you ripped off a crust and threw it to one and engaged it in a different manner? They're not like other birds in the sense, if you're out taking a walk and there's a crow in the grass near you, if you turn and look at that crow, it's going to react to you. It's evaluating your behavior, and they're doing that constantly. And I find that to be pretty fascinating. And they also recognize individual human beings. That's not something you're going to get out of a finch or a pigeon.
So if the crow knows me and it knows that I'm a nice guy and that I share my crust of bread with it, what do I get out of the deal?
If you were to feed that crow on a ritual basis, there is a possibility, not a guarantee, but there is a possibility that that crow will thank you by bringing you something in return.
So how do you even know that this is a thing that happens in the world?
Well, I was doing an interview about whether or not crows mourn and interviewing John Marsliff at the University of Washington, who's a crow expert. And while I was there, I remembered that years ago he had told me that if I feed crows regularly, there is a possibility that they might bring me a present. This has never happened to me, and I've always dreamed that it would happen to me. And so I just started asking him about that on the side. It was off topic, but we did it anyway. And that led me to the story that you're about to hear.
All right. Well, this story comes from Katie Sewell right here on Sound Effect on KPLU.
Now, how many crows can you see right now while we're standing here?
Probably about 10 or 20.
Do they all have names?
Not all of them, but we've named most of them.
Every day we clean all the water bowls and all the feeders. We take them down at night and wash them inside with the dishwasher.
Gee.
Just for their health.
Oh my gosh. Spacecraft.
So were you a lifelong bird feeder?
Big Punch.
No, I didn't feed the birds. Never noticed the birds until my kids started feeding the birds. It was a kind of transformation.
Spiky and Wish.
Have you named any, Lisa?
I did name one. I named one Bo because he had all his feathers missing off of his head when he was. Oh, I'm Gabby's mother, Lisa, a co-feeder of the crows.
Gabby, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes. I am Nature Girl!
Oh yeah, I'm Gabriella, that's my real name, but you can call me Gabby if you want. But usually the crows call me Nature Girl, so if you want, that's my nickname.
How did all this bird feeding get started?
Oh, me and my brother started it when we were 4 and 2.
Usually it would be whatever fell out of the car, which would be chicken nuggets if we stopped at McDonald's. French fries.
We gave them food out of our lunch boxes.
They decided they were going to intentionally drop things and drop more and more and more things to the point where Nicholas was willing to give up his whole lunch box on the way to school to these birds.
And as the mother that put those lunches together, possibly, how did you feel about that?
I was happy to share. I like it that they love the animals.
Now that's a sound I haven't heard in a long time.
Why do you think some humans, I can't say all, would be tempted to feed crows?
For some of us, there is this natural desire to bond with other forms of life. I mean, we have domestic animals for that reason. So when they try to engage you and they look at you and they sidle up to you and they don't immediately run away, people are tempted to, you know, make that bond tighter.
Woo! John Marsliff!
My name is John Marsliff, and I'm a professor of wildlife science.
What do you think of John Marsliff?
Oh my gosh, he's an amazing person.
Specializing in birds in particular, and maybe even more specialized onto crows and ravens and members of that family of birds.
Will it bring you a present if you keep feeding it?
I can't say they always will. I have seen an awful lot of things crows have brought people.
It's a very shiny rock.
I have a 7-year-old kid who brought in her whole collection of things crows have given her.
You might want to really see this.
It's impressive. There are probably 60 or 70 different items that she has cataloged that she has gotten from when the birds have been in feeding at her place. So,
is that something that the crows brought you?
Yes, definitely. This, it's kind of like a keychain. They gave it to me and it says best, and I don't know if they have the part that says friend.
But they haven't given that to you yet?
No. And this is a heart from them. It's showing me how much they love me.
It's pretty amazing when you see the sorts of things that some people get. And I don't know why they get them and we don't, but
you will never believe your eyes. They give me all the special stuff you could ever find.
The bond they form with that person might be even a kind of a courtship bond where they're bringing presents like they would to their mates, courtship feeding, for example. So some people, their presents are dead baby birds that the crow brings in. Other people, their beautiful pendants or shiny glass or trinkets of all sorts. And if you're lucky enough that the bird that really is conditioned to you is a gifter, then yeah, it's going to be awesome.
I don't have a match to this earring, but I do have an earring from them. I do have another earring, but it's not a match. You could put this on for your college dance night. But then your boyfriend will say, these don't match.
What will you say?
I'll say, this is from my friend Crow's.
I walk around with my holster, and it has two cameras on it. And I was out taking pictures of a bald eagle. I knew I'd dropped my one lens cap when I switched out cameras, and I just was busy taking pictures, and I didn't remember to pick it back up when I walked back home. And so about an hour later, I went out back to go retrieve it, and a crow had actually put it on the side of one of the bird baths. I looked at the surveillance video to find out if it was a crow that put it back, and it had put it back. You can see it bringing it into the yard, walks it to the bird bath, and actually spends time rinsing this lens cap, and then it puts it on the side of the bird bath. It's very impressive.
They are my favorite bird in the whole world because they're very smart.
What do you make of that?
I'm sure that it was intentional. They watch us all the time. If I walk down the alley, there'll be, you know, six or seven that just fly down the alley and see what I'm up to. The same with Gabby. When she's out, they will watch what she's doing. Even if you're not feeding them, they're just watching. I'm sure they knew I dropped it. I'm sure they decided they wanted to return it.
That story came to us from producer Katie Sewell. Her podcast is called The Bittersweet Life. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and as we think about creatures, you know, creatures can be our companions, our food, our way of making a living. And in at least one important historical chapter here in Washington State, the cause of a war. So here to help me tell this story is Mike Vorey. Mike, could you introduce yourself? Tell me who you are and where we are.
Hi, I'm Mike Vorey. I'm the historian for San Juan Island National Historical Park, and we are at the American Camp Unit, which is at the very southern end of San Juan Island. Very spectacular place.
So what is the name of this historical chapter that we're going to unfold?
We call it the Pig War, and it's not really a war because the only thing that died was the pig.
Why was this a place where international tensions began to arise?
So when the Treaty of Oregon was signed in 1846, they established the boundary on the 49th parallel, and it was to run from the Rocky Mountains, which the British called the Stony Mountains, all the way to the Pacific Ocean. But unfortunately, if they went by the treaty exactly, it would cut off the tip of Vancouver Island. So the two nations agreed to a water boundary, and the language said it will run along the 49th parallel to the middle of the Strait of Georgia through the channel that divides Vancouver Island from the mainland and then out the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Well, there was only one problem. There's actually two main channels, and the San Juan Archipelago is right in the middle. So the British said, well, anyone can plainly see that it is the Rosario Strait, so you Americans can just go away. And the Americans said, why don't you all talk United States talk for crying out loud? Anyone can see it's the Harris Strait. Skedaddle on out of here. So they figured since this was all the way on the far side of the world, let's just hold these in abeyance, hold them in dispute, and someday someone will resolve it.
This was a pretty remote outpost at that time, not a top priority for resolving this kind of an international boundary dispute, but that began to change. What happened?
First of all, the Hudson's Bay Company had established Fort Victoria, and then they established Bellevue Sheep Farm on this island in December of 1853. Now, this was a political measure.
So we have Bellevue Sheep Farm right over there. Who moved in next?
There was a gold strike up the Fraser River which attracted thousands of miners from the United States. And a few of them made their way over here to San Juan Island to winter in, so to speak. And one of them was a guy named Lyman Cutler. And he was about 3/4 of a mile northwest from the Bellevue sheep farm. Charles Griffin not only had sheep, but he had other farm animals, including Berkshire boars, which is a very fine British boar, and they're very notable for rooting, their rooting capabilities. In France, they root up truffles. And Cutler put in a garden, and they put in a crop of potatoes. Well, the pig discovered the potatoes and started rooting them up. So Cutler goes to Charles Griffin and says, "You need to keep that pig out of my potatoes." And Charles Griffin looks at him and says, "Well, you need to keep your potatoes out of my pig. You're nothing but a trespasser." Well, the next day, the boar is in his garden, and it's rooting up the potatoes. Cutler emerges from his cabin, runs back inside, grabs his rifle, runs outside, chases the pig to the edge of the woods, and then blam! Bacon.
Execution style.
Execution style. And no, I don't know who ate the pig. Visitors ask me that all summer long, and I can't say. So they threaten him with arrest. If you don't pay restitution for the pig, we'll take you to Victoria in manacles and throw you in jail. So Cutler wants to know how much the pig is going to cost, and Griffin tells him $100. And that's when Cutler says, and this is in his deposition in Whatcom County Superior Court, $100? I'm not going to pay $100 for a pig that ain't worth 10. If I see you in my place, I'll shoot you too.
So it's not only the unfortunate death of this pig, but it's something even more petty, really. It's haggling over the value of that pig that then touched off an international incident and brought the United States and Great Britain to the brink of war.
That's right. They get a message over to Captain George E. Pickett, who was commander of Company D, 9th Infantry. And the commander of the Department of Oregon, Brigadier General William S. Harney, says, "Nobody is going to threaten an American on my watch," orders Pickett to abandon his camp at Fort Bellingham and reestablish it in a secure location and not to allow the British to assume jurisdiction over United States citizens. When Governor Douglas found out about it on Vancouver Island, he immediately dispatched HMS Tribune, a 31-gun steam frigate, and HMS Satellite, a 21-gun steam corvette. And so John De Courcy, who was the magistrate, walks into Pickett's camp and said, "You need to leave, and if you don't leave, I'm going to place you under arrest." Pickett turns, he looks at his 60 soldiers and his 2 mountain howitzers and his 1 Napoleon gun and says, "I'm not going anywhere with you, sir." He was a Virginian. Pretty soon there's 3 warships out in the bay. Pickett's alarmed. He sends a message down to General Harney, a dispatch, and he said, "I'm a mere mouthful for them. Please send help." And they sent reinforcements, numbering 180 in the first contingent. Now on the British side, Captain Hornby had been ordered to go ashore, order Pickett off the island, and if Pickett didn't leave, take whatever measures you deem necessary to ensure that he does. The Admiral arrives 3 days later. This is our Lambert Baines. He hears the story and he says, "No, no, no, the damn fools. I've seen my decks awash with blood, and I refuse to lose one man over a dead pig." It was clear to him that not just the pig, but an island that was 55 square miles was not reason enough for the Royal Navy to initiate hostilities against the government of the United States, and he was not going to do that.
So are there lessons from this chapter of Washington State's history?
Well, the lesson that I teach generations now, I've been here 20 years of school children, is that individuals and nations can sometimes resolve their problems peacefully without resorting to violence. Well, having been personally involved in the Vietnam War in 1968 and 1969, I was appalled by the destruction, by the waste of human life and national treasure, and how it tore our country apart. I still believe
that we need to find ways to resolve our problems peacefully through diplomacy. And here in Washington Territory in 1859, the two governments realized that it was not worth fighting over, that diplomacy had to be done. And I think that's a good lesson for now. Would you rather have blood or would you rather have peace? I'll take peace.
Well, here to preserve the heritage of peace over war, Mike Vorey is park historian at San Juan Islands National Park and author of
The Pig War, Standoff at Griffin Bay.
Thanks so much, Mike, for being on Sound Effect.
Thank you.
Hey, stay with us. We are about to meet the shimmery little sea booger from the Salish Sea that has sponge scientists all in a tizzy over the origins of animal life on Earth. That's coming up on Sound Effect right here on KPLU.
Little things in there.
Yeah, I think. This is Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we are thinking about creatures today. And what you hear right now is me fishing around for a particular creature along with Professor Billy Swalla.
Oh, those are both jellies. So you see that? There's a jelly there, and there's
And this is a creature that Swalla says has taken our picture of how animals originally evolved on the planet Earth and kind of turned it on its ear. So Swalla is the director of the University of Washington Friday Harbor Laboratories, and she studies marine invertebrates. She's very interested in what were the very first animals on Earth.
Oh, yeah, see, that's a little phylidium. That's a little jelly there.
And the way scientists think about this is kind of like a family tree, where the bottom of the tree are the first animals, and then as you get higher on the tree, time goes on, you can see how the animals change and evolve and differentiate, and so you've got branches going out in all these different directions. Well, for a long time, scientists thought they had a pretty good idea of what the very bottom of that tree looked like.
So people thought that sponges were the first animal, didn't have true tissues, kind of sat on the bottom of the ocean, filtering. They have these specialized cells that catch bacteria, and so they sit and eat bacteria, basically.
But they don't move, they don't really do much of it. They could be mistaken for a plant.
Exactly, exactly.
And where did evolution go from there?
The next things we have are more complicated animals. You're probably familiar with jellies that we're calling jellies rather than jellyfish because they're not really fish.
So we're climbing up the tree. We're going from something that is just this side of a plant. That's my characterization. And getting a little bit more complex as we go up. And then eventually we get to
things like octopi or squid, which again, you know, have brains, have eyes, have behavior.
So this is, again, a sort of a tidy, pretty intuitive picture of the tree where we go from simple to complex. But there's a creature that lives underneath this dock that we're standing on that turned this all kind of on its head. And what is that creature?
That creature is a comb jelly. These are very clear animals that move through the open water, that move by combs.
And those are like little fringes of thread or
yeah,
hairs.
It looks like you might think of a little mop or something like that, or brushes, and as the brush moves, that the animal would move forward.
So comb jellies, and they're what are they called scientifically? Because I know we're going to drop this name in a minute.
Tenophores.
Tenophores, okay. So where are they?
So tenophores, you'll see them in the open water. They'll just be floating in the water with their tentacles out, looking for something to eat, and then we scoop them up with this little beaker on a stick here.
Okay, spoiler alert, let's cut to the end of this story and then we'll get back to figure out how we got there. What is so special about these from an evolutionary point of view?
So what we're really excited about is it looks like these animals may be the most basal animals. So in other words, instead of all animals coming from a sponge-like creature, we probably came from something like a comb jelly that had muscles and nerves and as an open predator. So it's a much more complicated ancestor than what we thought we had before as an ancestor.
How did something so complicated with all these complex body parts and behaviors and survival mechanisms like hunting, how did that just kind of pop up?
Well, that's a great question. One of the things we know is that evolutionarily you can lose things as easy as you can gain them. And so if we turn that on its head, the sponge has probably lost a lot of things because genomically, if you look at the genes of the sponge, it has many of the similar genes to the tenophore. And so probably at one time it did have nerves and muscles and it's just gotten rid of them and gone back to living on the bottom of the ocean.
So they're like cousins and sponges are like the dumb, lazy cousin that just sits on the bottom and kind of eats whatever swims through it.
Excuse me. Yes, that's right.
Am I making sponge scientists angry?
You are. Be careful. They don't like our results very much as it is because they really liked being the basal animal for many years and really don't want these comb jellies to be the basal animal.
How many other animals are built this way with these kind of nerves and these kind of muscle tissues?
Oh, absolutely none. They're all by themselves in their own category. And that's what makes it so exciting and sort of unique.
So they're built with like a very different set of instructions than all of the other animals?
Yes, absolutely.
So you've come up with all this by sequencing the genomes of these comb jellies and proposed a very different picture of what the bottom of that family tree looks like. And now you mentioned that the sponge people have been a little bit miffed by all of this. How does that kind of interpersonal disagreement play out in scientific circles?
So I have many sponge friends, I would just like to say. Many people who are
some of my best friends are sponge
friends
people.
That works on sponges, that's right. And they're very unhappy about it. I've told them, look at the data. As a scientist, what you want to do is look at the data. I have to say there's a whole spate of papers that have come out recently about this, and people are still arguing about it.
Taking shots at your
quite
work?
Vehemently. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Being at the center of this particular scientific controversy, is it fair to call it that?
Yes, it is fair to call it that.
What have you learned about how paradigm shifts happen in science?
Well, it's interesting because what I've learned is that when we are confronted with something that we don't understand and that isn't what we've usually wanted, you get angry. Once they start looking at the data, at some point a consensus is reached, and then people will have to come together and reach the consensus.
Do people take it personally? I mean, like, I've been saying this yes. for all these years, so you're calling me a liar.
Yes. I think, you know, if you've been saying something for, many, many years, and then now all of a sudden you come up with a different theory, people are going to feel like, I spent 30 years working on this. Don't tell me it's not true. It's true.
So how attached are you now to your results? If somebody did come out with sequencing something else, said, the squid is really the basal animal, how would you feel?
I would be mad. As a scientist, I realize that, I'm an emotional person, too, and I could be just as influenced, but again, I would have to look at the data.
And is this something that just happens when we have these kind of paradigm shifts? You get kind of an emotional resistance. It takes a little while to get over that, and then sooner or later, the data wins?
Yes. And sooner or later, the data wins, and then everyone says, well, that wasn't a new result. We knew that all along anyway.
Well, Billy Swalla is director of the University of Washington's Friday Harbor Labs. We're standing on a dock in Friday Harbor right now near some of her best friends, the comb jellies, who helped turn our evolutionary family tree on its side, if not upside down at least. Thank you so much, Dr. Swalla.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
It's Creature Week here on Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and for this next story, kind of a strange story, I'm joined now by senior producer Arwen Nix. Hey, Arwen.
Hello, Gabriel.
So this started for you with like a text message, right?
Right. So I'm sitting at work a couple months ago. My friend Adrian Levitt texts me, and the text message says, "How do you feel about animal communicators?"
I wouldn't know how to answer that. What is an animal communicator?
Well, that was my question. And it turns out an animal communicator is a fancy name for a pet psychic.
Oh, man. So were your eyes rolling?
My eyes were rolling a lot. My eyes hurt from rolling at this. I am a very skeptical person. And Adrian, I mean, he's a lawyer. He's a pretty logical guy as well. But I wasn't totally surprised by this text message because Adrian is really obsessed with his dog.
Yeah, these are Fern's small treasures. This is this jar I've kept since she was a puppy. I'm going to pour it out for you. So I have baby teeth and whiskers And when she was a puppy, I would like crawl around the floor in search of these. So I only found
These are some of the things that Adrian has saved over the years that he has collected literally from the body of Fern. You have the teeth he is describing, but also in the jar is a little piece of wood that had to be removed from Fern's neck, his dog's neck, when she was choking on it.
Gross.
Sure, gross, yes, but in some ways I really get it. I really identify with Adrian because I am obsessed with my dog. I don't have a jar, but I made a Facebook page for my dog. Like, I'm obsessed in a more electronic way.
Okay, so both of you, neither of you are particularly credulous when it comes to pet psychic mumbo jumbo, but you were willing to kind of go there because of your connection with your animals.
Well, it wasn't even that. I don't think that a pet psychic is something that either of us would have pursued ever on our own, but Adrian was gifted a session, a free session from his aunt, who is a big fan of pet psychics. And so when he decided to cash in on the session, we asked the psychic if I could record, and she said yes. We're in the Central District here, at Adrian's house.
Can you hear me?
There's no velvet curtains, no crystal balls. At least not that I can see, because the animal communicator is a vet tech in Idaho, and she does these sessions over the phone.
Sometimes when other people are in the room, mm-hmm. I might pick up messages for them, too.
Oh, well, I think that's an added benefit right now.
After that, she began. First with a body scan for health. Fern's head. Fern's neck. Fern's stomach.
I see a gas. In the colon area.
When the gas passes through, there's pain. So,
like, sometimes it will show me yogurt, but it's more like vanilla.
We stayed on Fern's stomach and Fern's gas for about 15 minutes.
Yogurt drops is what I'm hearing. Yogurt drops.
I'll look into that. Okay, sure.
Fern's stomach is fine, by the way. She's not a gassy dog. Another 10 minutes go by. We're halfway through. And Adrian starts asking his questions.
Why and what makes her have so much anxiety?
She's showing me light to dark, meaning sunrise to sunset. So I kind of felt you have to leave for any period of time on trips and such. Tell them how many moons you're going to be gone, because that's how they count the day. Play some nice, soft music when you leave.
Can I ask you another question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. One question I had for her is whether she feels big or small.
She feels like she wants to curl up in my lap, so she's trying to be small in a big body.
Right. I'm wondering why she hates golden doodles.
Dingy. I got the word dingy. The respect that she has for that dog seems to be like, what's wrong with them? You know, because it's all over the place.
So I'm wondering why she hates this one dog named Franco. And I hope that we could tell her that if she liked Franco, it would really help me out a lot.
So Franco has, I got the word ego, a little bit of ego here. So I'm going to put out that energy that this dog's annoying. Yes, we know that. Acknowledge that, yes. But she needs to get along with it.
Okay, so at this point, it seems like the session is winding down. Adrian got some answers. Most were pretty meandering. And we're both feeling a bit underwhelmed, ready for it to be over. When all of a sudden...
So Arwen, I want to talk to Arwen for a minute.
Okay.
Are you on your life path, journey, career?
I think I'm on my life's career path. I told her that. She told me not to doubt myself and... to be confident, stay confident. And change the name on your business card. And then this.
Okay, Arwen, do you have a grandma on the other side, a female on the other side? When I say on the other side, it means heaven.
I do.
When I hear this, my heart stops. I loved my grandma. She died close to a decade ago, and I really, really, really miss her. Just the chance that I could talk to her made my skin hot.
Grandma's showing me,
I smell the baking of cookies. I don't know. Did she bake? Was she a good cook? Like bake cookies, she said.
Well,
then she said Midwest.
No. No, she only ate raw food and she lived in Arizona.
And that's what made the next message so hard.
Acknowledging to me that you're doing good work while you're here on this earth and to continue what you're doing. But whenever you need kind of some guidance of any sort, just tune in to Grandma. This is what I'm hearing. The only thing you can't postpone, what's the word? Postpone in life is joy, okay? I don't know, I just write down things that come, so it might make sense later on.
You see, I've wondered frequently in the last decade if my grandmother would have been proud of me. She was not an easy woman to impress, but I couldn't believe it was her. The answers we kept getting about Fern, they all seem like the type of thing you'd read on the back page of a dog fancy magazine. So as I'm reeling, thinking about my grandmother, Adrian and the psychic go back to Fern.
I guess I wondered how long Fern will live.
Fern? I got the number 11, and I don't want to hold to that because...
So that was pretty much it. The takeaway for Adrian? Tell Fern how many moons you'll be gone for when you leave. Get her some yogurt treats to settle her stomach. A blue Kong. A nightlight because she gets scared. Play soft music when you go to work. And good luck with that other dog, Franco, but no promises.
Yeah, I really, really appreciate it.
You're welcome, and good things are coming your way. For both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I see dollar signs above your energy here. So, not that money matters, right?
I packed up my equipment and spent the next 3 weeks trying to figure out why I was so mad. I couldn't. It wasn't long after that I saw Adrian at a party. I pulled him away from everyone to ask for an update. And I was shocked. My skeptic friend had done a total 180 on this whole animal communicator thing.
You know, I thought a lot about, after the interview, whether maybe I was, like, too negative. And maybe I was too negative.
Would you have another session with an animal communicator?
I mean, yeah. Because you don't, like, there's nothing to lose. You don't lose anything from that.
Well, I guess not if it's free.
Sure. Correct. But I would spend $65 doing that or whatever it is. I would do that. Maybe I'll learn something new.
I won't let myself take anything away from this. As much as I wanted it in that moment, I won't change. I'm not, nor have I ever been, a believer. I'm just going to continue to post photos of the dog on the internet without any psychic involvement. Though, I have taken one piece of her advice. Okay, bud, I'm going to work. It's going to be like 8 hours. That's not even one moon. Zero moons.
Zero moons, buddy!
Sound Effect is produced by Arwen Nix and Kevin Kniestad. Katie Sewell contributed this week, and thanks to the Pacific Science Center. Our executive producer is Erin Hennessy. She is as patient and gentle with us as she is with those other hissing cockroaches. This show would not be possible without her. All of our shows are available on our podcast. You can find it at iTunes. And do tell us what you think of the show. You can email soundeffect@kplu.org or tweet at KPLU. I will be off next week, but Kevin Kniestad will be here to introduce us to some people who do what they do simply for the love of the game.
All I want to do is to present what I think human beings have done beautifully and leave it at that.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.